Session number 7363.
Mr. Jameson, tape 10.
I was going to say that when we went to the Somme, it was a delightful country, lovely rolling downlands and most attractive. But my impression, one of the Flares district, was nothing, was simply an impression of stunted trees, demolished houses, an unrecognizable remains of a village, mud up to the hocks pretty nearly, and filthy weather. A place you just die to get out of. Terrible. My impression of the other parts was that gradually and progressively the woodlands trees were shorn off to about stump high with shell fire. The ground was pitted all over. Your track to the front line was very much like that. And it was only when you began to get a mile or two behind where the fighting had been that you got onto nice, pleasant land again. But when you were in anywhere near the battle areas, where there's places that you read about, like Mametz Wood, High Wood, Pozières, La Boisselle, all those places, they were just shambles. It was surprising how you looked at a place and you wondered whether it would ever recover. And in some cases it hasn't. There are certain places in France, when you go and look at it now, where they just gave it up. They came to the conclusion that there was so much dangerous metal lying about, an explosive lying about in the ground, that the best thing to do was to leave it alone. We met on the Somme, of course, or at least that was the first time we met the Canadians, and we also met the Australians. The Australians were the biggest thieves you could imagine. Terrific, absolutely terrific. In fact, on one occasion we were trekking away, I think we'd left the Somme by then and we were route marching north, and the colonel, by that time we'd got Colonel Stirling. We were just approaching the business of being made into army brigades, and the sort of area fusion business hadn't quite been shaped up, but we were in the process of shift. Well, he was the colonel in command of the brigade at that time, and we were on the move somewhere, and we'd certainly left the Canadians, and he rode down, as he often did. He was a real martinet for march discipline, and every now and then we'd get an easy and a smoke, but every now and then as we marched at attention, be coming through a village or something, we'd have to spruce ourselves up. And old Stirling would ride down. He was the oldest RA gunner in the British Army. His son, as a matter of fact, did that raid on Rommel's headquarters in North Africa, Colonel Stirling. Anyhow, Stirling, he's in that book. He rode down the thing, and of course everybody was, you know, wondering what he's going to look for next, who was going to have something chewed off. And he got down to the end, and away in the distance was a jimmy cart wandering about all over the road, and two fellows sitting with their arms round each other, singing their heads off. So he clattered down here. I only know a bit of this by what I was told by the trumpeter who went with him. Clattered away down this place, and "What the devil are you doing here? Get out of that cart at once." These two folks sort of took this noise in and suddenly realized that something was telling them to get out. So they got out onto the road and made an effort to salute, and both fell flat on their faces. They were blind drunk. So he promptly sent his trumpeter up to get a driver to come down and take charge of the jimmy cart, get these two fellows piled into it, and "I'll deal with you people later." And when we got to the... when we got to our billets, wherever it was, before eventually going to reconnoitre the new battery positions to go back into the line again, these two fellows were court-martialed and got 7 days CB each. And we discovered where had they got this drink. They'd stolen a jar of rum from the Australians. Now, we thought that for anybody to steal a jar of rum from the Australians didn't deserve CB. They should have had a gong, you see. And the whole of the brigade were in sympathy with these two poor devils that old Sterling had belted them for pinching this rum when we thought they should have had a string of medals. Nobody could steal from the Australians. It was impossible, but they'd managed it. And they'd got this jar of rum and they had it in the jimmy cart and they were rocking along having slurps every now and then and singing their heads off, following along. Of course, what we did, because as a battery, you see, we had a lot of spare gear that we didn't really have official transport for. We were always adding to our creature comforts in one way and another, and these had to be transported, and we didn't get the forage and we didn't get the vehicles to move it. But we managed somehow to win a GS wagon and a pair of horses, which were not on the strength. And we had to feed the horses by just slightly tapering the rations to the rest of the battery to give them enough. But we never had, we'd never think of being stupid enough to have that come along with us in the column of route. Oh no. We would get hold of the driver of the GS wagon, who was a wild enough bird, and we'd produce a map to him and say, "Now look here, driver, we're going to so and so. Now this is the route you take," and we mark it off on the map for him. "And when you get to the other end, stay off leaves a bit, and get hooked up, park your GS wagon and your horses temporarily and come into the position that we've got here where you'll find our wagon lines, report that you've arrived, and we'll pick the right time for you to come back and join us." So we always used to send our illicit transport away when we were moving up the line. It was the back areas always. We'd say, always send that from in a roundabout route to arrive somewhere off limits, you see, and then get them brought in when we knew the colonel had had his inspection where we were and looked at the horse lines and approved everything and gone back to his headquarters wherever, and then that came in when we offloaded it quickly, merged it in with the rest of our stuff so that it wouldn't be recognizable. And the problem arose, of course, when we were handing in all our stuff at the end of the war and we had to account for everything. We had a GS wagon too much. So we set a party of 10 fellows on to dig a large hole, and we buried it in a Belgian farmyard, and we sold the horses to this Belgian for the permission to have to dig that in his ground. I expect he dug it up afterwards. But we buried that GS wagon. It'll be as deep as this picture rail. We had to dig a hole to get it in, because a GS wagon's a big thing. You know, it's as long as that, you see, and high. That had to be, we took the wheels off it and put it into this hole. And then we sold them the horses and we gave the money to the battery fund.
What sort of goods would these illicit ones be that you couldn't sort of declare that you wouldn't have been allowed to have?
Well, you see, we were allowed to have certain things issued by ordnance as part of our equipment. But then we wanted perhaps a few extra blankets, we wanted extra beds, we wanted chairs and tables, cooking facilities of various sorts, things to improve our general standards, and quite a lot of the stuff for the men too. We used to buy lots of stuff in the way of rations that were not on the strength, carry them in there and dish them out as well to the men so that they got a little bit extra here, there and everywhere. It always helped.
Do you think that was quite common with men?
Oh, yes, it was. Scrounging is a term well known in the army. Scrounging, it means getting something for nothing somewhere and something you weren't entitled to, which is another thing. But it was all good fun, and I think the powers that be recognised that scrounging was an army term that they had to accept. We had various musical instruments that people could perform on. You see, if we pulled up in a place and we parked there in found wagon lines, and for a matter of a day or two we might be sort of on release. We'd surveyed the place where the brigade was going to be panned out, where the positions were going to be, and we're perhaps given a couple of days' rest. We'd plugged a long way, we'd been in action somewhere else, and we were entitled to a breathing space. So we'd have a week's rest in billets before we went into the line again, if there was no show coming off at once. And on these occasions, we set out to try and amuse ourselves. And the usual thing, these French barns that had a huge extent, an entrance in the middle, and adobe wall with a bulk of timber along the top. And then they used to load all their produce over this and stack it up. So we would have the area here arranged as a sort of concert platform, and all the fellows would be lying up on the straw in the side, up the side there, you see, as onlookers. And when we got settled into a place and decided we'd have a battery concert, then anybody who could perform was down here, and nobody, that was all right. We had some very good singers and tuneful members and people in the battery one way or another, Durham miners, and they were very good, and some of them would produce a choir and sing, but invariably every officer had to do something. So you had to bone up on what you could possibly do. And Drew was he was very fond of Kipling, and so was I. And he never got beyond the "Come on, Major, we don't want to hear anything else. All we want to hear is we learned about women from her, or I learned about women from her." So it was a well-known thing of Kipling about this fellow's experiences with one female after another in different parts of India, I suppose. And Drew had to learn this up. And I can remember the thing I had to learn I'd spotted it in one of his books about Kipling. It was a story of an artillery gun horse called Snarleyow. And I could almost recite it now. But it appealed to me. It was all about this gun horse, and about its action in a native scrap, and about it being hit with a shell and getting tied up amongst the traces and whatnot, and one fella shouting.
Could you give us a sample of it? I don't know how long it is, but could you give a piece of it?
I've got the book up there. Let's see if I can remember it. Down in the infantry, nobody cared. Down in the artillery, cavalry, he sweared. But down in the artillery with the wheel at the flog, which is a reference to the fellows being tied on a wheel and given lashes at one time, with a wheel at the flog, turns the bold bombardier to a little whip dog. Now, this happened in a battery to a battle of the corps, which was first among the women and amazing first in war. What the bleeding battle was, I don't remember now, but two's off lead, he answers to the name of Snarleyow. We was coming into action. We was needed pretty sore to learn a little school into a native army corps. We'd run against an uphill and was tucking down the brow when a tricky trundling round shot gave the knock to Snarleyow. Well, we cut him loose and left him, because he's nearly tore in two. But he tried to follow after like a well-trained horse should do. And then he fouled the limber, and the driver's brother squeals, pull up, with Snarleyow, his head's atween his heels. Well, we... we wouldn't pull up for him because the wheels was going round and there is no stop conductor when a battery changes ground. Well, he hadn't hardly spoke the words before a tricky shell, a little right the battery in between the sections where it fell, and when the smoke had cleared away before the limber wheels, there lay the driver's brother, his head atween his heels. Well, the driver, he gave nothing but a coughing, snorting grunt, but there was no hesitation when it came to action front. And if the wheels was juicy and a trifle red, you can bet your bottom dollar it was worse for those so-and-sos or whatever. Now, the moral of this story is plainly to be seen. You haven't got no brothers when a servant of the Queen. You haven't got no mothers, sisters, husbands, wives or sons. If you want to work your battles, if you want to win your battles, take and work your bloody guns.
Did that go down well?
Oh, very well, yes. I sweated blood on getting that off as nearly as I could, and took a long time, but it always came up. You see, after all, these things only happened once in a few months, you see, so it was always the old things that came up.
Were they big occasions for you all?
Oh, yes, yes. We had marvellous times. Getting into these barns, and of course, they looked on the Major like a sort of father, confessor, parent, chief nurse, everything. And of course, having been a territorial officer in this battery in peacetime, they used to camp every year at Wynyard Park, at Lord Londonderry's place in Durham, and they were invited up to the house always for meals and whatnot. And the men knew like the back of your hand. He knew all their families. They were where they were engaged, where they were working, and so forth. And if they were in trouble, they got looked after. And that was why, as I say, when he had to go back to get his shipping business on its feet again, he said, "Look, Timmy, stay and see these fellows home."
Yes, I must get that story from you. That's at the end of the war, mm-hmm. isn't it? After the armistice. Mm-hmm. Did you ever have, going back to the concert parties, did you ever have professional turns
never.
Come out?
Never.
No, you never saw anything.
We were so much in the sort of, shall you say, semi-devastated areas, and we didn't see much of civilization. We had to go back quite a way before we could find a farmhouse where we might be able to buy a loaf of bread. We weren't in contact with the civilians. At one time I thought I might have been able to get my French going, but improve it or learn a bit. We didn't have the opportunity. And the only times that we could, that we had any contact with civilization was when we were given 24 hours leave, go back to a town of some size, have a wash and a bath and a good meal somewhere, and come back again. It was only that amount of time, you see, enough to have a good feed, a good wool out, plenty to drink, and a real bath and clean up, and then back to work again. And that was one of those. That one there, the bland smile, was a ride into Amiens, I remember, and a meal at the Gobelin, I think it was, or the it was either the Gobelin or the Hotel du Rhin, was another one that we used to get into and drink far more than was good for us, and oh dear, sleep it off and come back to work.
You mentioned the Australians and Canadians at the Somme. Mm. Were they good troops?
Yes, the Canadian was first class troops. As I say, we supported them in their attack on the Vimy Ridge, and they did a marvellous job. We had them on our left, on the Somme, and they were good. The Australians were marvellous troops, but uncontrollable. They were going to show the world that they could wipe the Jerrys off the face of the earth. Now, all right, they were good. It wasn't until later, after they'd been pretty well blooded several times, that they began to learn restraint. They could capture a position all right, but you see, they ran out of steam and they ran out of support and everything, so that it was wasted. Marvellous fighting troops. And general or anybody was anywhere else but cover to them, you know. Everybody was equal in the Australian eyes. We're all equal in the sight of the law. They were, by Jove, they didn't have any respect for anybody.
Were they liked by the British troops?
Not really, because they were thieves.
Sort of things would they steal?
Oh, anything. Equipment, always useful stuff, you know, useful to the war. They would whip telephones and things because they'd hand it to somebody.
Would they steal a man's possessions, a soldier's possessions?
Not more the sort of things that could be useful to them. Or, of course, if somebody had a load of drink anywhere and they thought they could whip it, they would do that.
Hence your delight when these people got drunk on their drink.
Yes, they were used. These people who must have been used to hard liquor, and they could mop it up and stand it. And for those two lads to whip a jar of rum from them, we thought it was absolutely VCs, you know, EFC with bar.
But the Canadians, were they respected more than the Australians, would you think?
Yes, they were. They were prepared to listen to people, the Canadians. They were prepared to learn, and they were first-class soldiers. And I got on, my own personal recollections of them is that I got on very well with them.
Were tanks used at the Somme?
Yes. I can't remember when, though. I can remember the terrific hush-hush about these tanks coming, and I can remember the hush-hush about them getting up, because they were very slow-moving things, and getting them up towards the front line. Of course they were used. What am I thinking about? There was once, they were in their infancy at the Somme. Of course they were. And there was this derelict one in the middle of High Wood, and there were various other ones stuck around flares. Oh, yes.
Were they effective there?
They were effective in this respect, that they caused fright. Not so much as a fighting weapon, because they were unwieldy. And my brother told me later, in fact, when they were even a bit more mobile, when he was riding in one of these, when they attacked the Hindenburg line, and Canadians bust the Hindenburg line, and he was in a tank company that was supporting them, inside a tank, and they got over, and they were... By that time, the Jerrys had got a bit more used to the idea they could tackle a tank if they went the right way about it. And one of them had sneaked up around the side of it. Of course, your vision is very limited. It sneaked up around the side of it and got hold of the pom-pom around the muzzle, around the barrel, you see, and pulled it down so that if anybody fired it, it would fire downwards, because this thing was stuck out and you were busting off at things, you see. And he dived around the side and got hold of this and pulled it down. And, of course, the gunner sitting inside on a saddle and a platform here with the gun on it was trying to pull it back again and couldn't do it with this weight of this fellow on the other end. And my brother happened to just look out through, see this thing happen, and he looked out through the thing and he just got hold of this and pulled the trigger and blew this old Jerry to pieces. And then he got his gun back.
Did the Germans have tanks?
No. They had some very mobile artillery. They had some very excellent gun platforms of sorts, very mobile, but no.
Better than ours, would you think, their artillery?
Better mobility than ours, I think. Yes. Although our bigger guns, eventually they were on wheels with pads all around them, you know, and they walked like flop, 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 that sort of thing. I was reading that book. Somebody was talking about suddenly a gun went off somewhere near him, and he had this terrific shock, and it nearly blew him off his feet. And then he saw the shell vanishing away. Well, you could always see that. Any howitzer, if you got behind it, when they fired it, you could always see the shell travel away. With an 18-pounder, you had to be very quick. If you got dead over the top of an 18-pounder, you'd just suddenly see this, like that, and it was gone. But it's very difficult to spot. But a howitzer, oh yes, you could always see the shell.
Did you ever see any signs of our super-heavy guns, the railway guns?
No, I didn't. I saw